I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I have a conversation with Bassi Iqbi, author of the new book of essays titled I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying. It's a memoir in essay form that guides the reader through what it's like to live with bipolar disorder and anxiety. And this is one of the most arresting, beautiful collections of essays I've read in a really, really long time. As soon as this collection of essays was published, it quickly became a New York Times bestseller, and it went into its second printing the day that it was released. So I was really honored to have the opportunity to have this conversation with Bassi Iqbi. We open our conversation with my describing my reaction to the book and my deep emotional connection to it. So here is my conversation with Bassi Iqbi. So I just wanted to start by describing my relationship to your book. And I don't remember exactly how I became aware of your book. I don't know if someone recommended it to me or I read something. Typically, I have these books that I read for work or for the podcast. Then I have another category of books that I just kind of read for pleasure. And so your book fell into that latter category. I was just going to read it through the holidays and, you know, just kind of enjoy myself. So when I started reading it, I wasn't prepared. You know, I was just taken aback. And my first thought was, you know, who wrote this? And at the time, I didn't know that it was a bestseller, right? I was truly stunned at the beauty of it and the poeticism and the vulnerability you have when you talk about your experiences, you know, with bipolar disorder and anxiety. And then I became this really annoying person and I just started carrying the book around in my purse. So whenever somebody would invite me out for, you know, for drinks or for coffee, you know, I'd pull the copy of the book out from my purse and I'd say, you know, have you read this book? Because it's really incredible.
Oh, wow.
Because there were just so many people in my life that I thought would benefit from reading it and who would grow and would get some meaning from it, right?
Oh, that's so cool. It's so cool. I'm always interested in knowing how people find it because I'm never sure if it's just like the interviews or I don't know how any of this stuff works. So hearing that is really amazing. Thank you.
You know, the thing that stands out to me most is the language, right? The poetic language, right? Because you're a poet, right?
More or less.
Well, yeah, right. More or less, right? And, you know, I read somewhere, it was probably an interview with you, that this book was not the book that you started out writing. This was not the book that you originally intended to write. And that you thought you'd write something like a self-help book, you know, this kind of a typical piece of nonfiction. And I have to tell you, I'm so glad that you did not write that book and that you wrote this one. Can you talk about what the evolution for you was like getting from that first book to what you eventually published? What was that evolution for you like?
I have friends who say that I've been trying or wanting or speaking about writing this particular book for as long as they've known me, like going back 10, 15 plus years. And it's true, that is a conversation I've had. But when I was given the opportunity or presented with the opportunity to write a book, in 2016, I went through one of the worst depressive episodes of my life. And what I realize now, looking back, is that I have been in this spectrum of depression or a mixed episode, like I describe in the book, for almost a decade, if not more. And I was only a little bit better, meaning not as depressed. And when I got to 2016, the year I turned 40, everything hit me like a train. And I realized that I was in this space where I didn't want to try anymore. I was exhausted with it. And I spiraled in this way that I was 100%, now I wouldn't say 100% because I'm still here, but I'd say a large percent, like 80% certain that I didn't want to be in this world anymore. And I started slowly preparing my friends and my family and my therapist for the possibility that I wouldn't be here by the time my birthday came around or even a little bit afterwards. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to I've always wanted to do as a writer is to write a book. And I was also thinking very practically in that this is revenue for my child and my family, my siblings. This is, you know, this is something that they can, you know, collect on. Because in my mind, I had this, I'm not really worth a lot right now. But if I'm dead and I have a book, then all this stuff is going to be perfect. The rational irrational is what I refer to it as. But I didn't want to write that book. I wanted to write something different. I wanted it to be a Super Soul Sunday type of motivational kind of, this is what I've learned and going through all of this. These are the lessons I've taken from it, and I hope that it helps somebody else. And I struggled to write that book because it was false. But it's a book that we sold when I eventually got an agent. So I felt like I had to write that book, but I struggled so hard. And I was very fortunate to have the editor that I have at HarperCollins, Aaron Wicks, who saw that I was struggling and had said to me when we had our initial interview before I decided to sign the contract, that she wanted me to be sure I was ready to go there. And when you want a book contract, when you want anything, you're like, yeah, sure, I'll go there, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, sign me. I'm going to do that. But I didn't know what she meant until about a year into the process, and I'm struggling. I'm writing all this stuff that I don't like, that I don't connect to. I'm you know, having this real conflict with the things that were going on in my life, in my mind. And I remember I was in New York for a couple of weeks to just write, because I figured I needed a change of scenery. Something had to give. And I met with her, and I was really honest with her. No. What happened before that was that I wrote Like a War first. It was the first thing I wrote in this new thing. I wanted to free myself. I wanted to see if I got it out of my system, if I wrote these different ways and wrote it the way that it was coming to me in, you know, in different points of views and in different perspectives and different tenses and really playing with the genre of nonfiction. If I got that out of my system, maybe the other book would show up. And then on top of that, I was also, like I said, in 2016, writing these notes and letters to my friends and family, explaining to them how difficult it has been my entire life to exist in this way. And I was trying to show them that I had done the best that I could, and they, more importantly, they had done the best that they could, because this is all the things that I was contending with that they didn't even know about. So how could they have possibly known? But now I'm telling them, right? Those are two separate projects. So when I decided that I was having trouble writing the book because there was something else that needed to be written, I went to my editor with Like a War, with the one that eventually became Tahuti, and with the one that's the really long one in the middle that's broken up into, I don't know what anything's called because we changed the title so much, but the one that's broken down into like time increments. I wrote those three and I presented it to her, and she was like, do this, whatever this is, forget what we were doing before, write whatever you feel like, and I will figure it out as far as, you know, punctuation, the way that the words come out, whether or not the diction needs to be fixed, like just write it and figure it out. And once she gave me that freedom and that permission, I just took it and ran. And this book, combined with those letters and notes that I was writing to my friends and family, all of that came together. And this is what happened. It was a very long answer.
No. It's really good. And you know what? I'm so glad. I'm so thankful that this is the book that you wrote. I mean, obviously, right? Because it's a New York Times bestseller. Yeah. People are connecting with it.
And I was so scared. I was honestly like, I felt like I had freed myself, but also limited myself. I didn't know if people were going to get it. I didn't know if people were going to accept it. The agent that I had, like, we're no longer in a business relationship because he didn't get it, you know, and he wasn't really supportive of the changes. So I had to like really trust myself and trust my editor. So I'm just very, very grateful that it has had the reception that it's had.
You know, that does not surprise me. You know, I'm not sure why it doesn't surprise me that he wouldn't get it, but it doesn't. It doesn't surprise me at all. Anyhow, so here's the reason why I found the book really meaningful and more important than what you might have written in the, you know, the first version of this book. And, you know, honestly, you know, I have to say that from what I feel and understand about the person who wrote this book, I can't even imagine you writing that first book. It just feels like that's somebody else's book, right? But anyhow, you have a way of connecting the reader with what you're going through in this really kind of visceral way, in a way that I've never read before, right? Because I think a lot of people who write about depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder, you know, they start to, I feel like they start to take on the language of the business, you know, kind of this medical language. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And you don't do that. You know, you can't read your this collection of essays without walking away with a deep, deep sense of empathy. You just can't.
Thank you. I mean, I made a conscious decision not to do that. And one of the things, I struggled with when I was writing the book that I eventually became, I got really nervous that maybe I was doing a disservice to people, especially Black people, especially Black women, especially women. You know, I was doing a disservice by not being more statistical and maybe not tying it into like things that were going on in the world. Like, should I mention Sandra Bland? Should I, you know, like all these different things. And I had to stop and take a breath and realize and remember that most often we don't feel like our stories are enough. And I had to write it like a white woman, more or less, where I just had to assume that everyone's going to care about what I said and make sure that the stories were pure enough that people wouldn't wonder how come I wasn't tying it into all these other grander sociopolitical things going on. And I think that a lot of Black writers, I think we tend to feel that we have to, regardless of training, become cultural anthropologists. And I wanted to avoid that at all costs. Number one, because I'm not a cultural anthropologist. I didn't research anything except for just live my life. And it was really important to me that people saw themselves in it and weren't able to dissect themselves from any experience. I didn't want anyone who read it and needed to see themselves to have any excuse to completely divest from the experience, right? So a friend of mine who I've known for years, when he read the book, he wondered why I didn't include a lot of the living in New York and going to deaf poetry and all that stuff. And I said, and I said that it wouldn't matter if I were living in Wisconsin and going to teach every day. These things, these symptoms, these feelings, anxiety, this depression, this hypomania would have shown up the exact same way. And had I focused on this very unusual life and career that I've had, people would be able to say, well, that's because she was on TV. You know what I mean? That's because, you know, all these other things were going on. And I wanted to be as clear as possible that I wanted people to either see themselves or see other people very clearly in it.
It's really important that you said that, I think, because it's really instructive for writers to really, you know, kind of connect with the authentic experience that they feel like they want to have versus like the direction that other people are trying to push them in. Do you know what I mean?
So as a first-time author, especially, I thought that once I did this thing or signed this contract, there was no budging from it. And if it wasn't for the fact that I have more experienced authors and writers in my life who are telling me, you can change the title if you want. You can, if you don't like that cover, you know, tell them you want another one, because people are afraid. First-time authors are afraid to do that because they think it makes them difficult, or like they don't have any credit behind them, so they can't prove that this is going to work or not. But one of the things that was stressed to me was, this is your first book. If it goes well, everyone is going to take credit for it. If it doesn't, you're going to be the one who's blamed for it. You're the one who's going to have trouble getting, you know, other deals or other work. So fight for what it is that you want, and be sure and be clear that the people in your corner, in your camp, on your team are willing to fight for you as well.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview. You were talking about reading Mary Carr's The Art of Memoir, I think it's called, right?
Yes.
And I actually have that book. I haven't read it yet. But you talk about the fact that she says, if you don't have a good memory, you shouldn't write a memoir.
Yeah.
Like I said, I have the book. I haven't read it yet. And that, to me, I think it struck a nerve in the same way that it struck a nerve with you.
Yeah.
And that the point is that people write memoirs because of difficult things that have happened to them, right?
Yeah.
And often what happens is your mind doesn't want to hold on to those hard things. And so you can't really rely on factual memory as if you're reading, you know, a history book. Like, that's just not how memory works.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just curious about you. Like, how did you pull together your factual memories with kind of like those emotional memories to pull together this memoir?
I had to be very honest with the fact that I do have a faulty memory. Something that I remembered very recently was that I used to write journals. I used to keep journals when I was a kid, and I used to throw them away every year, which is, I didn't know I was going to be a writer, but I threw them away because I didn't want anyone to find them. I didn't want to be particularly reminded of anything that I was writing about. I also kept extensive journals when I was in college. And when I started writing this book, I was like, oh, it'd be cool. I have actual, proof that things happened. I'm going to go and read these journals. First of all, don't ever do that because embarrassing. But one of the things that I noticed too was that there were pages and pages that had either been ripped out or I covered with whiteout and then wrote on top of, or I would type something out and then paste it over the page. There was so much that I did so much work to not remember certain things and to make sure that it was never remembered that way. And I had to really explore why that was. And because the book wasn't about why I didn't remember things, I had to, again, give myself this permission to try and convey and help people understand why my memory was as disjointed as it was. And then also know that the disjointed memory is just as much a part of my history as anything that could be corroborated, by my sister or, one of my best friends when I was in elementary school or what have you. For instance, this conversation, what you feel about the mic situation a couple of minutes ago is completely different than what I feel about the mic situation, right? We're having the same experience or a very similar experience because we're talking to each other and we're having it together. But our recollections of this in a week, in 2 weeks, are going to be completely different. Does that make your recollection any more true than mine? No, it just makes it different. And I think that once we allow ourselves to recognize that all kinds of things influence the reason why we remember things the way that we do, I don't know what the science behind that is. I want somebody else to write that book. But for me, I had to just reconcile with the fact that there are things that I either don't remember because they fell into these, episodic depressive episodes or hypomanic episodes, or I willed myself to forget because I needed to rewrite them in order for me to get past them. And that's all just an honest part of the way that human beings are. And I think that any memoir that's written as though it is 100% fact and 100% true is lying. Telling the truth, but it's lying. I just don't think that's an honest thing to say. I just don't think that people have been able to have the space to admit that they had to fill in some blanks. I think that the relationship that we as a society have with truth and lies is a little bit skewed. And the process of writing this book and after having written it, I've completely changed the way that I approach what I believe to be dishonesty and try to be as empathetic and compassionate with someone who isn't telling the truth, because the reason why they're not, to me, has to be more important than the thing they're trying to protect, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, but you can only read it that way if you take the word memoir literally. Right? And I don't think anyone takes it literally. It's not a literal memory of the history of a person's life. You know what I mean?
Right. It's not an autobiography. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I struggled with was that I kept calling my editor and I was like, well, I don't remember what happened in the fifth grade. And she was like, this is not a comprehensive, autobiographical timeline of your life. It is bits and stories. Like, you can write a memoir about your entire life from one perspective, the perspective of you being someone who's always late, and then write the exact same life, except for the perspective of someone who cries at all the movies or whatever. And I think that once we start to realize that it's about prism and the way and perspective, then we'll be a lot more forgiving as far as how we accept what somebody's true story or memoir is.
Yeah. I mean, this is just one person's opinion, but I personally feel that, emotional memory is more helpful to readers than, the factual recounting, the linear factual recounting of a person's life, right?
100%. Yeah. Especially when you're talking about really difficult subjects.
Yeah. And, Speaking of difficult, one of the things that is, the whole book, it's beautiful and it's hard to read and it's sorrowful and it's just, reading about your experiences as a child, right? I guess I just, I felt this profound sense of loneliness, even though you were kind of always surrounded by people like uncles and aunties and, you know, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I remember this one passage that just stuck with me where you said the relatives around you, they said, she doesn't cry. She's like a stone. Right. But you were you were right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you heard them say that. And I feel like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you mentioned the word lonely. I don't know. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's very accurate when it comes to, especially, I mean, all I have is the Nigerian immigrant experience. Quite often children are to be seen and not heard. And so they will discuss you as though you're not there. And then on top of that, I was parentless because my parents were away. So I was really not a part of whatever it is that was going on. There was definitely a loneliness that I still experience to this day. I think that at a very young age, I realized that my relationship to other people was largely performative in that I figured out very early what would make people happy with me, what would make people sad, what would make people excited, or, you know, stuff like that. And I was more about the reaction and the performance of to get that reaction than anything else. And that's a lonely experience because you're not truly ever having many genuine moments. That sounds a bit more sinister than I mean, but
no, I get what you mean. Yeah.
So I knew that I didn't want to upset people. So I did things that, you know, and told them things that would make them happier or to change their mood for the better. And it made it very isolating because I wasn't feeling that always. And I didn't know whether or not I was allowed to feel the ways that I was feeling because, you know, when we think about depression, I think a lot of us just kind of think of it as like an extreme sadness. And when you look at it that way, you think, well, I don't really have anything to be sad about. And that becomes dangerous as you get older, as I got older, because then I started looking for things to be sad about, which is also not healthy. But it does create this invisible barrier between, you know, you and the world. And I think that I've always, to this day, I have to fight to remove that invisible barrier. And then 9 times out of 10, I just leave it up. Like, it's fine. No one really cares what's going on back here.
Yeah. But, you know, I feel like, I know you say that you worked hard to figure out what people wanted and the reaction they wanted from you. And you were kind of taking care of them emotionally in that sense. But I feel like even if you didn't do that, in a lot of the scenarios that you write about, I didn't feel like that safety net, that place to land would have been there for you. And I'm specifically talking about when you were a child, that would have been there for you in the first place. Like, you know, the story of someone killed a chicken for dinner, right? And you saw this.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know how old you were when that happened. But like I said, I have an 8-year-old and I know that if he saw that, he would struggle to recover, right?
Like, I have a 12-year-old who would struggle if he saw something like that. Yeah. But it's a very different thing in Nigeria. It's a much different thing when you're not in America. And that's something I spent a lot of time back in Nigeria from 2012 to like 2014. No, 2015. I left in 2015. I spent a lot of time there and I was able to understand myself as a child a bit better when I was there because I saw as an adult how children were socialized and the things that they were subjected to that we wouldn't think of subjecting kids to in America. And I don't know what the reason for that is, but it definitely made more sense when I saw it as an adult. Not made more sense like it was, oh, good job, but like, oh, that's why I feel this way about X, Y, and Z. Because the society made that possible.
No, I get that. And I kind of understood that context from the book too. You know, specifically, I don't want to stay on the chicken story too long. But specifically thinking about that, like I was trying to think of it as like, yeah, that's a cultural thing. The thing is that you are still an individual. You are who you are.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the more empathic thing would be to meet children and individuals where they are, right? When I would read those stories and expectations were placed on you that you couldn't necessarily meet, like just be okay with the chicken being killed. Like, I just wanted to scoop up that little girl and just say, you know, it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've learned about myself, especially as a parent, is that I am because of those kinds of experiences, I am much more attuned to my son's emotional needs. And I tend to them in ways that I think and I hope will make him feel heard and seen and respected as his own person, as opposed to something or someone that belongs to me. And that's really important to me, because I always felt like I belonged to the village, belonged to the, you know, to the family, belonged. I was a possession as opposed to someone who needed specific kind of care because of the specific kind of child that they were.
Yeah. That's funny. I agree with you on the parenting thing. My own kid, just to give you a personal anecdote, because that story just stuck with me because he's 8 and he's a vegetarian, and he's been a vegetarian since he was, since he was 4 for this specific reason. And, you know, we're not vegetarians, right? But I remember when he was 4 years old, he lectured me. He was like, "You don't understand. Like, I know where that chicken came from. Like, don't lie to me." And you know, he was very, and I was like, and it dawned on me, it's like, what's normal for us and what's normal in our society may not be his normal. Right. Like, you know, other kids, you know, they go around eating chicken nuggets, but, you know, he thinks about where the chicken came from. And like, just because it's normal for 99% of us, like, I just really think that you have to meet kids where they are. And like, he was 4 and he was telling me, like, you know, don't lie to me. I know where this chicken nugget came from. So anyway, speaking of normal, first of all, I want to talk about the Shuttle Challenger story, because this is a story that I think where I felt like, you know, the people around you kind of let you down in the way that we kind of always let children down. So that Shuttle Challenger story, everybody knows the story. It was in the mid 80s, 1986, I think, where the Shuttle Challenger went up, and, you know, classrooms across the world, kids were watching the Shuttle Challenger go up. And, you know, the tragedy happened, right? It exploded, and you saw that and you internalized that, right? Like, you felt it was your fault.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you said that was pivotal for you.
Yeah. One of the things that I can add to that, and because the stories were constructed in very specific ways, I didn't want to have a bunch of things branching out. But around that same time, there was this correlation that I had made to myself in world events. For instance, just Nigeria, I would, you know, get a bad grade or lose a spelling bee. And then I'd get home and my dad would be like, "Oh my God, there's a coup in Nigeria. There's the war started and, you know, there's famine," like all these different things. And he wasn't saying it to like stress me out, but I would make that connection. Like, I would do something wrong or not okay, or I wasn't proud of, and then people would die, you know? And so it was something that was bubbling in the back of my mind that I didn't really pay much attention to. I just kind of like, "Oh, okay. Again, cool." But the Challenger, because that specific moment when I was so excited, I was looking forward to it so much that I had to steady myself and close my eyes and look away. And I felt like if I had kept my eyes on them, had I not taken, and I think I write this in the book, but had I not chosen my own comfort and discomfort over honoring what these people had worked to do, they might have still been alive. I don't really know what the specific connection was, but in a general sense, it was about the fact that I felt this huge responsibility at a young age for so much and so many. And that responsibility was something that I didn't really know how to handle. And I only had like a tenuous grasp on in the first place. But to watch that thing happen, and of course, when the book came out, people around my age all identified with feeling very, very shaken up by watching that explosion. And I think that we also were at a time when we didn't have grief counselors. We didn't have, you know, people who were really checking for the emotional well-being of children. I think once they turned off the TV, they're like, "All right, that's it. We'll talk about it a little bit, and then we're not going to talk about it again." And I was a child who needed to talk about it again. And I didn't realize that was the case until, again, much, much later, when I saw that same kind of emotion and emotional responsibility show up in different ways as I grew.
Yeah, because it's kind of it's a theme throughout your book, right? Like, you feel very emotionally responsible for other people, even when you're in deep, deep suffering.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you, at that young age, when did you start to notice that there was what you'd call a normal reaction and then the way that you reacted. Because I know that you use the word normal a lot, right? Like, did you start to say like, oh, that person didn't react to the shuttle Challenger disaster in the way that I did? When did that start to show up for you?
It was a Challenger explosion. The story about the Challenger explosion was the moment when I, because it was something that a lot of people experienced at once. So I was able to gauge it better. So the thing with me, you know, failing a test or getting a bad grade on test, I never really failed, but I always remember this failing, but got it a grade that I didn't like, or I knew that my parents wouldn't like, or doing something that I wanted to make them happy with and then having to disappoint them, even though they weren't really, they didn't care if I won the spelling bee or not. I mean, they cared, but not the way that I had held it up, so that I was disappointed on their behalf, like I had built it up for them. But it was a Challenger because so many of us experienced it, not only in the class, but eventually all over the country. I could see, okay, Jennifer cried and then she came back to school the next day and she was fine. You know, Josh was upset and he came back to school the next day and he's on, you know, he's still pushing people over it at recess. Why am I not able to jump right back into where I was? Why am I unable to get to the space where it was all okay? Am I the only one thinking about it? And I might not have been. I don't know what they were actually going through, but the way that it felt and how heavy it sat on me, my reaction couldn't possibly be the normal reaction. And I use normal a lot in the book because it became the thing with which I used to gauge my space in the world. My relationship to normality now is much different in that I know that normal is a baseline for which I operate, and that makes sense to me. And my normal is not somebody else's normal. Your normal isn't my normal. You know, I had to learn to rephrase that or reframe that much later in life. But at the time, normal meant that I was looking at everyone else to see how they were reacting, what they were doing, what it looked like to experience the same thing I was experiencing, and just kind of like, just, you know, close my eyes and try and figure out how to be like other people as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you even write that. You said, I need to remember what normal feels like so I can imitate it.
Well, there you go.
I think people don't understand about people who struggle with, you know, mental health issues is that, you know, on top of struggling with the illness itself, there's this extra burden, this energy and this work that it takes to always, always compare yourself to what you think is normal. Right. Yeah. I mean, that must be exhausting.
Oh, absolutely. It's where one person is only thinking about the one thing. I was thinking about 100 things and making sure a bunch of things were in place. It was tiring. And what made it even more exhausting were the times that I couldn't sleep. I could never shut those running themes and narratives down because I didn't have that luxury.
You know, another thing that the book did for me was it made me kind of slow down, right? Kind of slow down in my reactions to other people around me and to stop and consider what they might be experiencing, right? And react to people with a lens of openness, you know, because what we think we see in people's behavior isn't always what's happening. You know, what might seem like anger or impatience or, you know, someone who's confused, you know, that might actually be anxiety. And the person might be trying to work through that anxiety in real time. So it helped me realize that sometimes I needed to step back and work harder to allow room for other people to go through their experiences. You know what I mean?
One of the most important things with the book was I hoped that it would do what you just said, which is open up these chambers of empathy, because often people are only empathetic as far as they can pity another person. They're not empathetic when it's inconvenient or disruptive or annoying even. And if you realize or if you understood just a little bit how much is happening in the head of someone who lives with anxiety, depression, or bipolar, or what have you, then just a split second before you react to it, just like, whoa, take a minute. There's something else going on, and then move from there. I mean, you could still be a jerk to them, but at least you thought about it.
So I want to talk about the role that race played in your treatments and how you were perceived. There's that chapter, Take Two for Pain, right? Which was so hard to read. And it's a really beautiful essay. It's one to struggle through, where you were taking pills to help you survive and to help you get through these days, right? Yeah. And you were at a party and you were doing some things that were kind of putting yourself in danger. And there were people around you who seemed really worried about you.
Yeah.
But me, you know, as a Black woman, I was thinking about that scene and I was like, you know, she may or may not have been in that space, right? Like, she could have been in a space where somebody just said, oh, you know what? You know, that's just another, you know what I mean? That's just somebody who has not earned our empathy, right? And I was so nervous for you in that moment, but luckily you were with people who cared about your safety. So I just want to talk about the role of race and how that played and how people perceived you.
I can answer that in two different ways. I was very fortunate. I have been very fortunate that there have always been people who have wanted to take care of me, for better or for worse, have been very protective of me. I haven't had the negative experiences that people would think would come with some of the things that I've described, especially in the book. I've never been assaulted. I've never been, to my knowledge, I'll just say it like that, I've never felt like I was in any danger with other people. I don't know whether that was, you know, the babies and fools, you know, protection or just that I think that I've always had like a survivor in me that was always leaning towards whatever would make me live as opposed to leaning towards what wouldn't. And I made sure that I was as safe as I possibly could be while being reckless in that way. And I also think that this is going to sound like my mom, I never ran with a bad crowd. So it wasn't people who were just self-destructive. You know, it was very, they didn't know that I was being self-destructive, right? So they were very protective of this person that they knew, like, we don't know her to be like this. Let's make sure she's okay. I was always in spaces where I was okay. As far as when it comes to being a Black woman, that's something I definitely thought of as the book was being written. And I realized some of the things that I was saying and some of the stories that I was telling. I was very worried about how people would receive that and receive me, whether it would change how they saw me. I hoped, and I think that I had set up enough of a narrative that would make you want to root for me and maybe see me and in turn see other Black women who are struggling, who are not living the way that many would be able to identify and say, oh, she's good, she's not good, or whatever. You know, like, I wanted some of that to be removed. And again, I wrote it in a way that I wanted people to see these stories, not as my story specifically, but as stories of people once you give them a chance to show you what they are, as opposed to you trying to define who they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and I kind of got that when you were talking about your friends, like the one friend, is it Diane?
Yes, Diane.
In the story, right? And I could tell that you were surrounded by lots of friends who loved you and cared about you.
Yeah. Diane and I became friends after that. Like, she and I, like, she was a young poet in the poetry scene. And then that goes back to what you were saying before. I've always been someone, thanks to my dad, I think, someone who's always led with kindness. So I was an older poet. She was younger. And I was always kind to her and talking to her. And we have these different kinds of interactions quite often. And we'd spoken about, you know, depression and whatever. And I gave her the number to my therapist. Like, I'd been open to, with her in that way. So for me, I think that the person that I was, even when I was hiding what I was going through, helped nurture and helped shape the people that ended up inevitably being around me at any given time.
And again, I have empathy because that's a lot of work.
A lot of work.
Right? Like, you were trying to take care of the emotional needs of everyone around you.
Yeah.
Right? And so, but I get what you're saying. You set up an environment and a community, you know, by caring and, you know, which we should all do. Yeah. and in turn, they took care of you. But I was thinking also, like,
I was thinking of you in, you know, the hospital setting and, you know, where you don't have people around who know you.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel that the perception of you and the treatment of you was, I guess, hindered in some way because, you know, of being Black?
I honestly don't know. And that is something that people have speculated on in, like, before I stopped reading reviews, that people had wondered or assumed that. And I left it ambiguous because I just wasn't sure. I wasn't in the space to be clear about that. I feel like maybe my parents suspected that, which is why they instructed me the way that they did. Just pretend, you know, just get out of here. My mother is a nurse, and I remembered every time that I've had to be in the hospital, my mom has been very concerned about my grooming. Like, do you have deodorant? Are you changing your clothes? Like, this stuff. And I thought she was just being a nag for like I'm sick. The last thing I want to do is put on deodorant or, you know, fix my hair. But what I've realized or come to realize is that that does affect the way that you're treated in the hospital. Especially when you're not able to advocate for yourself. So I feel like those things were part of it. I just wasn't in the space emotionally to see that clearly. It was the furthest thing from my mind, but it can't be too far when you're a Black woman. You know what I mean? So
Yeah. You know, I think about that a lot. You're right. And I've never talked to anyone about that. So thanks for bringing this up. I'm from the South. I grew up in the South. And a lot of Black people in the South are very, you know, particular about their nails and, you know, the dresses that they wear to church. And I think that that does come from always kind of being overly concerned about the perception, because, you know, how you're perceived can equate to, you know, how you're treated, obviously. And when you're in the hospital and you're very, very vulnerable, I could see that. Like, I could see.
Yeah, because they don't know you. And I said that in the book, they don't know you past your chart. You know, they don't know you past what the nurses have whispered about you during the shift changes. You know, they don't know that. And especially online, I've seen these conversations about respectability politics, and we shouldn't teach people that they have to be a certain way in order to get respect. And I get that. And I 100% agree, except for the fact that that's not the world we actually live in. So we can't just throw some of these things out because they saved our ancestors' lives. But I definitely do understand why our elders were so particular about the way that we presented ourselves. I understand it fully.
Speaking of relationships, there's this one scene in an essay where you were at a party, and I think this is where you met someone you were a partner that you had named Derek, right? Mm-hmm. And you said you did the split. Did you actually do?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't do it
like
now.
A real full, I was going to ask you, can you still do that? Like, I have never in my life, even when I was 12.
Yeah, I was a hardcore dancer. I was in high school, I was on the pom squad. And then in college, I was co-captain of the dance team. Like, I was in there.
Wow.
And I used to love to dance. And I didn't go to parties when I was in high school because I wasn't really allowed to. I think I went to like one dance and prom. But I used to watch like Video Soul and like all these videos and see all these dances, and, you know, my sister and my brothers and I would be doing it in the living room. And so when I got to college and I was going to parties, I was breaking out all the moves. And I had, what I said in that essay was true. Like, people were like, oh my God, like, oh. And I was like, I'm literally just dancing. I do not understand what's happening right now. I don't get it.
Like, not only did you do a split, but like a full on split, but you did like a booty pop.
Yes. It was 100% dance hall, random dance hall video that I'd seen once or twice.
And then you met your next partner, your next boyfriend. But, you know,
that's well, years afterwards, because that was, it happened when we were in college. And then when we both moved to New York at separate times, and we met up in New York.
But that's memorable.
Yes.
Like, of course, he's going to remember that for years.
Yes, apparently.
But, you know, one of the things I read recently, I think it was on Twitter, where someone said, was giving advice to writers who write memoirs. You know, they said, you know, take care of yourself when you're doing these tours, mm-hmm. because one of the things that people don't think about is that the things that they write about in their memoir, especially if they're painful, they're going to have to talk about them over and over and over again. And like, people are in the audience, you know, they don't necessarily respect your boundaries.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're just going to ask you any old thing, right? Like, how have you dealt with it? Has that been hard?
Yeah, I've been very clear about my boundaries, which is I'm so grateful for my therapist, because she's been prepping me for all of this for like the last 3 years. Like she just knew that it was all going to be great, and she was just going to, that's what we're going to work on. We're working on boundaries now. So I came a lot more prepared than I thought. One of the things that I did or do is that from the stage, before the thing wraps up and people are getting ready to, you know, line up for the book signing, I'm always very clear that I don't write inscriptions. Like, I'm not going to write to, I don't know, Lakeisha's mom, you know, and then write something and then write my name, because that stresses me out. Like, that gives me a lot of anxiety, because for some reason, I think that I need to write something different for every single person. And so I'm struggling to think of something unique. And I've literally just met this person when they handed me the book. So that takes away a lot of the anxiety that I walk in with. But then it also gives me an opportunity, because I know, again, because of the nature of the book that I've written, that this is going to move and motivate people to want to have conversations with me. So I'll have an hour long book event and a 2 hour long signing line, because people just want to talk. And I know that it'll be selfish of me to have written a book like that, asking people to examine certain things, knowing that it might trigger something in other people, and then disallow them to have a conversation with me about it. I don't think that's fair. That's my personal choice. So I have to do as much as I can to make sure everything else gives me the room to be able to have those 2 hour long signing lines and have an individual conversation and do a lot of hugging and be able to look in people's eyes and listen to what they're saying and give them some advice, or just listen, hug, and then keep it moving, because I know that it's important. And I know that if I was coming to someone who I felt was speaking to me and they were dismissive of me, that would be more hurtful to me than anything, because now the person that I think understands is not available to me. I had to figure out different ways to balance what I needed to give and how to replenish that.
You know, I just, you give so much, right? You just, you know, just want to thank you, you know, on behalf of the world and all the people, like you're even giving to strangers, like you're worried about the experience that people who come up to you at the table. And I understand that you know, you've been through some of the things that they probably are experiencing. I just feel that need in you to still make sure that everyone's okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm just so glad that you're okay, because you were able to give us this gift.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Electorette is independently created and produced by me, Jen Taylor Skinner. And of course, I'm the host. But I also do all of the editing, the audio, and the graphics. You name it, it's on my plate. So if you enjoyed this episode of The Electorette, please help The Electorette grow by subscribing. Just hit the subscribe button on whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. Also, leave a review for The Electorette on iTunes. Lastly, one final way to help The Electorette is by following The Electorette on social media. That's at Electorette on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, keep up the good fight.